The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and welcome to yet another in our series of clinical focus podcasts. We're working through the entire spectrum of medical and nutritional problems, and hopefully we will provide you with a lot that you will find to be of value in terms of your practical understanding of various medical conditions and of the use of natural therapies, supplements, and of course, high-tech medicine. That's what we call intelligent medicine. So our clinical focus series so far, we've tackled Alzheimer's disease. We've tackled the problem of underweight. And today we're going to talk about cholesterol-lowering supplements. Now, why am I talking about that this week? What inspired me? Well, a couple of things. This week, a big study came out last week, looking at niacin as a means of lowering cholesterol. And the study came up, unfortunately, very short. So we're going to comment in this podcast about the role that niacin may or may not play in lowering cholesterol and combating heart disease risk. And at the very same time, a very nice review came out, put out by ConsumerLab.com on cholesterol-lowering supplements. You can check it out at consumerlab.com. And so we're going to talk about your possible choices in terms of cholesterol-lowering. But let me frame the conversation, first of all. We really have to ask the question, is cholesterol-lowering in and of itself of value? And part of the problem is that we have so successfully sold the notion that high cholesterol is bad for you that virtually everyone has signed on. It seems that the world is divided into two camps, people who are worried about their cholesterol and are willing to take a statin drug, and people who are worried about cholesterol and want to take a natural product to lower their cholesterol. And that's why the sales of natural products that purport to lower cholesterol are astronomical. It's a little bit like the sales of natural remedies for erectile dysfunction. If you don't want to take Viagra, well, you still may have a problem, so try something natural. But is that a good idea when it comes to cholesterol? And the answer is that while cholesterol is a risk factor for some people, we can't completely dismiss cholesterol as a risk factor. There are a lot of people who have high cholesterol for whom cholesterol lowering with statins or with supplements really won't make a difference. So if you refuse to take a statin or you don't want to take a drug, is it really warranted to take a natural therapy to lower cholesterol? Well, we really have to come to the decision process by which I discern whether patients need to lower their cholesterol. And often, I will see patients who have a high cholesterol, but they will have a high HDL cholesterol. And that is generally protective, but we can't completely depend on high HDL to fend off cardiovascular risk. Say someone has a cholesterol of 300 and they have an HDL of 80. That looks good because their ratio is less than 4 to 1, slightly over 3 to 1. And that would seem good. But unfortunately, some people have genetic risk factors. They may have high blood pressure, borderline blood sugar. They may have had a history of smoking. They may have other concomitant risks like high homocysteine, high Lp(a). And oh, by the way, we can slice and dice the LDL cholesterol. So the LDL is too high according to the standards of the American Heart Association. They'd like to see it under 160, or for some people less than 130. If you've had a heart attack, they want it even lower, 100 or 70. The so-called bad LDL is something that provides doctors with sort of a paint-by-numbers method of deciding who needs attention. And it's a very crude measure of risk because LDL can be further characterized. You can break it down into its subparts, and you can look at the particle size of your low-density lipoprotein. There's low-density lipoprotein where the particles are large and fluffy. That would be the type A pattern of LDL. And there are individuals who have what is called pattern A, which is small, dense LDL particles, which are far more dangerous. And so these are some ways of discerning risk. And you can, you know, do all kinds. You do the plaques test. You can even check for oxidized LDL and even apply a ratio of oxidized LDL to HDL. I actually find that that is a very effective way of determining who's at risk. And very few labs do this, and very few doctors bother to do this. But this can be a useful way of discerning whether people are at risk. But the ultimate way to find out if people are at risk is to look inside their arteries. And a non-invasive way of doing this, I mean, you can do this via an angiogram that involves stringing a catheter up through your femoral artery into your heart and squirting some dye in there. And, you know, that's an invasive procedure. And so there are ways that are non-invasive that can help spot the presence of plaque in your coronary arteries. My favorite is the EBT heart scan, which involves less radiation than what is called the 64-slice coronary CAT scan. I prefer the EBT heart scan because less radiation gets to the patient, and it helps us to discern whether people are at risk. Perhaps they deserve cholesterol lowering or some degree of protection. And I don't believe cholesterol lowering is the only strategy to employ when somebody is at risk, but it's one of the strategies. I mean, obviously, you need those patients to exercise. You need cardioprotective nutrients that have anti-inflammatory effects, and fish oil, and so on, the whole panoply of nutrients. That's not what this particular podcast is about. We'll do a podcast on heart health and heart protection at another time. We're talking about cholesterol right now. But you can look inside the artery with the EBT heart scan, and you can get a number. And if the number is zero, if the number is very low, then in spite of what seems to be high cholesterol, that person is probably at very low risk, and there probably isn't a strong, compelling reason to use a statin drug or, alternatively, a natural therapy. So everybody asks, you know, what can I do to lower my cholesterol? The first question to ask before you decide on what to do for your cholesterol is, should you do anything about your cholesterol? Don't just stand there. Do nothing in some cases, because you may not be at risk in spite of numbers that seem to be apparently somewhat high. So what do you do if it is decided that your cholesterol is high and you want to lower it? Well, let's take a look at some diet and lifestyle measures. In my opinion, cholesterol and saturated fat don't have a heck of a lot to do with your cholesterol numbers. Your dietary cholesterol bears only a slight impact on your ultimate cardiovascular risk. So, you know, we really don't look to that as the main way of reducing cholesterol. This low cholesterol food, low saturated fat foods, these are not our primary way of lowering cholesterol. There are instances where people go on a totally vegetarian diet and their triglycerides, which are a source of cardiovascular risk and actually contribute to cholesterol, skyrocket. So this approach of eliminating or reducing cholesterol and saturated fat for most people doesn't really work. What does work is restricting sugar and refined carbohydrates and, in many cases, starches. And this will result not so much in a lowered cholesterol, but an improved ratio. When I went from a totally vegan, vegetarian, ultra-low-fat diet, my cholesterol at that time was about 135. Sometimes when I tested, it was even lower, 128. But my HDL was very low. It was 32, 35. And I switched to the opposite kind of diet, a diet relatively high in organic meats, lots and lots of eggs, whole fat, butter. And the net result was that my cholesterol went up. Indeed, it went up to over 200. It was 205, 210. But my HDL soared to 75 or 85. And the resultant pattern was probably improved. Now, here's a little caveat, is that sometimes people can have high HDL, but their HDL is ineffective. And this is actually something we can measure when we subfractionate LDL to find out whether people have good or bad LDL. We can also subfractionate the HDL. And there's some types of HDL that are the good HDL, and there's some types of HDL that are not so good HDL. So we might discover a person who ostensibly has a decent HDL, but a lot of their HDL is the less beneficial type of HDL. So this comes to another, helps us introduce another topic, which is niacin. And niacin for a long time has been looked at as an ideal agent to combat cardiovascular disease, because it is one of the few things, in fact, the only thing that I know of as an agent, and some, you know, it's sort of halfway between a drug and a natural agent. It is a natural vitamin B3, but in a dose much higher than you would find in foods, in a concentrated dose, it acts like a real pharmacological drug. And its unique property, unlike statins, which lower cholesterol, but they also tend to lower HDL, niacin ideally lowers LDL cholesterol, and it also raises HDL. And it also helps to lower triglycerides, which is an important feature of its mode of action. It's unique in that ability. And one other side benefit is that niacin also helps to lower what's called LP little a, which is a little known risk factor for cardiovascular disease. So it would seem, you know, on paper, that niacin would be great for reducing cardiovascular risk. The only problem is, and this is a problem that I pointed out earlier, is that there is often a disconnect between your numbers and your risk. So, you know, virtually half of people who die of heart attacks die when they're on statin drugs or when the cholesterol seems to be perfectly normal. So it's not always the case that risk is obliterated when you fix the numbers. So really, one of the problems with niacin research is that it took them a long time. You know, they saw the good results. People had better cholesterol, you know, just like certain things lower blood pressure or lower blood sugar, but don't end up prolonging life. It took them a long time to figure out that while niacin appeared to improve numbers, it didn't necessarily lower risk. Now, the results on niacin research are very perplexing, because initial studies in the 70s and 80s showed that niacin was very beneficial in terms of reducing cardiovascular risk and improving survival. And so on the basis of that, a whole niacin industry was spawned. And in fact, there's a drug called Niaspan, which is about $1 billion a year drug. Soon, I predict Niaspan and other forms of niacin are going to crash and burn because, well, niacin has an annoying side effect, which is it causes flushing. And that, you know, causes a lot of people to abandon the use of niacin. It's really harmless, but it's uncomfortable and unpleasant and embarrassing because, you know, you walk into a board meeting or something and your face is bright red. And people are thinking, what in the heck has this guy just been doing, or this gal? You know, why are they blushing beet red? So it's a pretty, not a very dangerous side effect. There are other potentially dangerous side effects of niacin, but the most annoying side effect of niacin is the flushing. So it's you get worse flushing with the crystalline form of niacin that's available in health food stores. You get a reduction in flushing with what is called extended-release niacin. But the problem with the extended-release niacin is that it's the form of niacin that is most dangerous to your liver. One of the cardinal problems is it will cause liver function abnormalities. It can actually pretty seriously damage your liver. And so without the flushing, a little bit of a warning sign, you may consume more niacin than your liver can tolerate. And it's very variable. People have different levels of sensitivity to that liver effect. Some patients get it very early on, taking 500 or 1,000 milligrams of niacin. Other people can tolerate 3,000 to 6,000 milligrams of niacin, no problem. So it's very difficult to predict. There's an intermediate form of niacin, which I've used for a while, but I haven't used it that much because I've felt a little reluctant to use niacin. The flushing is less than with the crystalline niacin. It's a delayed-release form of niacin that is available in health food stores. It's a wax matrix. They use a wax, natural wax matrix to allow it to break down more slowly and time release into the system so you don't get the niacin hitting your gastrointestinal tract rapidly and causing flushing. So in my experience, niacin can cause liver problems. In fact, there was a guy who wrote The 8-Week Cholesterol Cure named Dr. Kowalski in the 1980s. It was a very popular book. It was a huge bestseller because people started being aware of cholesterol. They thought, great, self-care for cholesterol. I'll just buy some niacin. Well, he got sued by a number of individuals who had very serious problems because they just followed his instructions in the book. And he forgot to tell people, oh, by the way, get your liver functions checked and do this under supervision of your doctor. And so he was successfully sued by a couple of dozen patients, one of whom had serious liver failure. I think one or a couple of patients had to have liver transplants, very, very serious problems, because they irrationally kept taking the niacin even though they felt sick. Usually, if you're taking niacin and you start feeling a little nauseous, that's a sign that your liver is probably taking a beating. You can also get stomach pain from niacin. It can have a gastrointestinally irritating effect if you're prone to ulcers or gastritis. And so fast forward to 2014, Merck has been working very hard to develop a way of delivering niacin that is non-flush. And so they came up with a very fancy and, in my opinion, over-engineered solution. They combined it with another substance, which was a artificial prostaglandin-like molecule, a drug that neutralized the flushing effects of the niacin. And so, if that had worked and if it was safe and effective, this could have been a multi-billion-dollar drug. And because it wasn't just regular old niacin, Merck would have had a patent on it and would have been able to hold the patent. And that's the name of the game in the pharmaceutical industry. Just don't resurrect some old-fashioned something that's available in a health food store. That's not going to make you a lot of money. Create a unique blend. Niacin, that's old hat, but mix it with something called lorpiripant, which is the non-flush component blocking the flushing. Well, they did the study, and to their horror, several things happened. One, there was no cardiovascular protective effect of the niacin plus lorpiripant called Tradaptive. In addition, there was a slightly higher, borderline statistically significant increased risk of death. So it wasn't even protective. It didn't reduce heart attacks, didn't reduce strokes, and it may have slightly increased the risk of death. And, oh, by the way, a significant number of patients had a worsening of their blood sugar control. By the way, that's a feature of statin drugs to a certain extent as well. But niacin does that. And then there were patients who had increased numbers of infections. That was unanticipated. And also some bone problems, some increased risk of osteoporosis, although not very highly significant. So this multi-billion-dollar research project, it probably cost them hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to develop this drug and test it, has crashed and burned. So if you're a Merck stockholder, this is something that may impact you because they had high hopes for this drug. If you're an ordinary person who's considering taking niacin, you got to keep in mind a couple things. One, all the recent studies on niacin have been done with niacin as an add-on to statins. And the reason for that is because they think if you're going to do a long-term study, it would be statins are so good, they believe, that if you were to do a study just giving a person niacin versus a statin, it would be unethical. It would be unethical to deprive them of the purported benefits of the statin drug. So when niacin is used in recent studies, it's used as a piggyback onto statins. So say somebody's taking a statin, they're not getting the best reduction in their cholesterol and their HDL is still low, they would add niacin to the statin. Well, if you do that, you will increase the risk of liver problems. And it's a little bit like if you want to test the usefulness of suspenders, test it with people who are already wearing a belt. You know, if you're, you know, using a statin and niacin is a little bit like wearing a belt and suspenders at the same time, because both are designed to hopefully synergistically lower cholesterol and lower risk. Well, they found no added benefit when you added niacin, but the people were already on statins, so maybe that erased the potential for niacin to be good. So what does that mean for people who are still taking niacin? I still have a few patients on niacin when they really need to lower cholesterol, when they absolutely can't take statins or red yeast rice, which we'll talk about in part two of this podcast, as we talk about other natural alternatives for lowering cholesterol. For the most part, I'm pulling back on my niacin prescribing. I never really prescribed it that aggressively. I always had concerns because it created liver problems and it created serious flushing. And its benefits were not that clearly established. So with all that, let me just say that, you know, there are a lot of people taking niacin in a multivitamin. Don't worry about, you know, 25 or 50 milligrams of niacin in a multivitamin. There's some people who I even sometimes get a slight flush when I take a B-complex that has just 50 milligrams of niacin. You know, I'll look at myself, you know, in the mirror while I'm combing my hair at work, and I'll see my face is all red, and I'll go, gee, a couple hours ago I took my multivitamins, got 50 milligrams of niacin. Okay, maybe that's what's going on. Not a problem. The flushing is non-harmful. It's bothersome, but usually isn't indication of any harm. It does create consternation, but not a big problem. So having covered niacin, which I think is one of the more important stories as an alternative to statin drugs, let's consider this part one of today's podcast, clinical focused cholesterol lowering supplements. And in part two, we'll talk about some of your other supplement options in terms of lowering cholesterol. That is, keep in mind, if you have to. A lot of people erroneously believe that we need to play cholesterol limbo. How low can you go? If it's your cholesterol is okay, make it even lower. No, that isn't necessarily the case. There may be even a beneficial function of cholesterol. So if you don't need to lower it, why bother? But if you need to, stay tuned for part two. We'll evaluate some of the additional options for natural cholesterol-lowering supplements. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.